science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
Just jumping straight into the show, that's what I'm doing. We're getting right on in there. NASA's latest mission to Mars.
Yeah, Marcus. So you may have heard yesterday, NASA put another man-made thing on Mars. It's a lander. It doesn't rove around like some of the other ones that you may have seen. So it landed. It went through a sort of a 7-minute period of slowing down and entry into the planet's atmosphere, and a really complicated procedure where, you know, there's a pretty high chance that things are going to fail and it's going to go splat. But it worked. The parachute slowed it down, and a little sort of retro rocket slowed it down enough, so it was a nice soft landing. It went down from what, about 20,000 kilometers an hour to what, walking pace in the space of about seven minutes.
That's pretty impressive.
It's pretty violent slowdown.
Yes.
Yeah. But it's there, and it sent some pictures to say it's there. And so this probe is pretty interesting, really. So it's called InSight, which stands for
This name is amazing.
Yes. Another forced acronym. It's Interior Exploration Using Seismic Investigations, Geodesy and Heat Transport, which does say spell InSight. So
they just really wanted to call it InSight.
They did want it to call it InSight, so they made it fit. We've had rovers that rove around and look at rocks and take pictures, and we've had other probes that look at some sort of try and see if there's subsurface water and things like that. And mostly what the probes have looked at in the past are things connected with the surface and the atmosphere and whether life is there and things like that. What we don't know very much about is what the interior of Mars looks like. Okay, so we know a lot about the interior of this planet because we are able to look at seismology studies to see whether we've got a molten core, what the temperature is down there, you know, plate tectonics, which are pretty important in New Zealand, where you know, the sort of surface plates are moving slowly over time and lead to earthquakes and volcanoes and things.
It's also a bit more accessible than Mars, studying our own.
A smidge. Yeah, just a little bit. So the idea is that this probe is going to do the same sort of thing. It's got a few different instruments on it that look at, you know, how the there's a seismograph or size. Yeah, seismograph that looks at how the structure of the planet has how it is at the moment. There's a temperature probe that does very accurate measurements of the temperature subsurface, so that it drills down a little bit into the planet. And there's even a sort of an instrument that will tell you how much the planet is sort of wobbling on its axis as it moves around the sun and it spins on its axis, because Earth wobbles a little bit.
What does that kind of thing affect?
And all of that sort of combined gives you information about the core of the planet, you know, the temperature of the core, whether it's still got a molten core in the middle, because it's we really don't know in Mars, and whether there are any plate tectonics still active on Mars. There's no signs of any plate tectonics on Mars, but there could be very sort of minor things that are going on. Mm. And Mars is sort of in this Goldilocks region, and it's big enough as a planet to have had the molten core like Earth does. Yeah, big enough to have that internal heating, but it's probably small enough so that most of that has gone away, and the geology may have been stable for millions and millions or billions even of years. So we can actually by looking at these data sort of get a much clearer picture of the history of Mars, the sort of the geological history of Mars, much more easily than even on Earth, because Earth plates are moving around, things are changing all the time, you know, and
it could be much more stable.
And it's much more stable on Mars. Yeah.
So that sounds like this non-rover, this staying still.
Probe
it's got lander. A lot of work to do.
It has.
How long are they planning for it to be there?
I think it's a 2-year mission.
Okay. It took 7 months to get there.
It took about 7 months to get there, yeah. So it was launched last was it March or April? I can't remember. Yeah. And well, the interesting thing, it was actually launched with a couple of other little mini probes that went along with it that are now in orbit around Mars. And they were there. They took some pictures of Mars, but they were monitoring the progress of the lander as it sort of went through the atmosphere, went through this sort of fiery descent. And made sure everything was okay.
So the results, though, will we be getting that as they come, or are we expecting like a massive report in about 3 years?
Good question. Okay. I don't know. I mean, the data, apart from the pretty pictures, which are always nice to look at, I mean, the data is going to have to be processed and analyzed, and so there'll be massive. No doubt hundreds of journal articles related to this.
But this is a big thing deal, really, because we're.
It's a big deal. It's a big deal, but it wasn't as expensive a mission as a lot of the other missions have been, because it actually relies on technology that was already sort of somewhat developed. So there was a Phoenix lander in about 2008, I think, that did similar sort of subsurface studies, but towards the North Pole of Mars. And a lot of that technology could be sort of repurposed and used for this mission. So less expensive.
I'm wondering, because the previous rovers and probes that were sent seem to be done in sort of a prospective way. Well, the idea was like, we kind of potentially want to have people sent over there or grow things, or, you know, like, let's see if we can do that, if there's life. This one seems to be more for just sort of general knowledge about the planet, or could it have any, like, I think
you're being quite kind about the human race there, Lisa. Sure, there's always a kind of imperial.
Well, it's just like the
reason behind it.
Imperial.
The idea that we're gonna, or explorational, or.
Well, I think in this case, it really is just trying to understand how the geology of Mars has changed over the last, I don't know, 4 or 5 billion years since the planet formed. It's still a fairly open question. We still don't know an awful lot about how planets in general form. Mars is a good candidate because we can actually go there, sit on the planet, and do these really intricate studies. I don't see how this can benefit human colonization
directly.
We already know, I think, that the plate tectonics is really at a minimal, if at all. So it's not like you're going to go there and have a volcano erupt underneath you or anything like that. I think this is just, how can we understand planet formation?
Okay. You know?
All right. I knew we were going to talk lots about these topics, so shall we move to the next one?
Yeah, of course.
We've got a powered plane with no moving parts.
Yeah, this is really cool. So if you think about airplanes, you know, there's propeller-driven planes where you have a propeller moving that's pulling you through the air, or a jet engine that's sucking air in and pushing it out the back so that it propels you forward. And all of those things, they're things that are spinning. And all, you know, a propeller engine, this thing, and a jet engine, there's mechanical moving parts, yeah? These guys, there's a group here at MIT, but other people have proposed this as well. There's a group at MIT that have realized that you can actually make a plane that's powered, it propels itself forward, but nothing on the plane is moving. Okay.
What?
Well,
how?
So what's happening? What this is there is a what you can do is ionize air. In other words, you can if this plane was built in such a way, so you they create an electric field, okay, and at one end of the so there's wires at the front and wires at the back, and at the front end of the plane. The electric field is strong enough to bombard atoms with electrons, molecules in the air, mainly nitrogen and oxygen, with electrons, and this rips off a few electrons. So you're actually ionizing, you're creating positive N2 nitrogen molecules, or positive oxygen molecules. And these are charged now, okay? And a charge likes, you know, a positive charge likes to go towards an opposite charge, so what you do is you put a negative electric field at the back, wires that are at a negative potential, and these molecules accelerate towards the back of the plane.
What?
Okay.
And so they're accelerating towards the back of the plane. And as they accelerate back, so you have this wind blowing back over the plane, which goes over wings, which give the plane lift.
Wow.
Push the plane forward.
The normal way of flying a plane.
Exactly.
Whoa. So what sort of energy are we talking here? Just powering.
Just electrical energy.
The
so it's you're just putting two sets of wires at differing potentials, electrical potentials, One enough to ionize molecules in the air, and the other one at an opposite potential, so it's or a lower potential, so it accelerates the molecules towards it, and that's it.
Is this like this the future of flight travel and a more sustainable option?
No.
Oh.
Well, probably no. So this has been proposed. This has been proposed since the 60s, and people tried to do it, or even earlier, and people tried to do it then. But the difficulty is, you have to be able to put enough energy into these wires, power these wires to a high enough potential to be able to do exactly that—to rip, to produce ions and everything. So you have to carry your own power source. Okay.
Okay.
Now we're creating a plane with no moving parts. So you could put a gas engine there, but a petrol engine or something, and that will have moving parts. So that not, and they're always heavy. Mm. So we use batteries.
Yeah.
Okay. But batteries, until recently, have always been pretty heavy. So you put batteries on there, and then you just don't have enough power, enough thrust to get the thing flying.
Let alone people and luggage.
Before you get to that. So this guy here in the group did some calculations. They realized that now maybe with modern batteries they could potentially do it, and they did. So they did 10 flights. Each was a 10-second flight or something, and each time the plane actually gained a little bit of altitude. Mm-hmm. So these were powered flights, and there's a video on the connected to the paper, and showing that you could do this. And so future applications, you think, well, maybe so these are potential systems that could be maybe solar powered in the future. So you got solar panels on the top, charging batteries, which do this. But once you start adding people, once you start, making a 747, it doesn't scale.
No.
It doesn't scale very well. So it gets very heavy very quickly.
Because, at the moment, how big of a plane are we talking about?
This was a 10-meter wingspan, which is pretty big.
It's pretty big.
But it only weighed 2.5 kilograms. This is really lightweight for something that size.
So early days.
Early days. Yeah.
But
so I think future applications for... high altitude drones that could just really indefinitely fly around. They don't need fuel. They can, if you have solar cells on there, and they're stealthy, they're quiet. So you think military might be interested in this sort of stuff? So
it always
goes downhill a bit.
Way to ruin it, Marcus.
But NASA is working on it. It's not the same idea. This plane does have moving parts, but it's an example of this sort of distributed electric propulsion. So normally you see a plane with, say, a propeller on each wing or something like that, or a jet engine on each wing, But NASA's been working on ideas where you have, in the case of their planes, this is the X-57 plane, whatever, but there's 14 battery-operated propellers on the front wing. So it's moving parts, but it's distributing the power that way.
Yeah.
Actually, it makes the plane go further on the same amount of energy. Yeah, but the great thing about this one is with the NASA plane, if you add more propellers, you increase the drag, more moving part, more things spinning. With this plane, you could add more wingspan, add more electrical wires that create more of a thrust, more ionized gas, and you don't really increase the drag very much.
Yeah,
All right, that's exciting.
It is. Now I was talking to
drones.
30 seconds. Yeah, I was talking to a colleague who pointed out, and what you're doing, if you imagine a fleet of millions of these things flying in the atmosphere, they're squirting out a lot of ionized oxygen and nitrogen, which are pretty reactive species.
Right.
Maybe when there's ozone around, which could react with ozone maybe, or certainly react with other things in the air, producing nitrogen oxides and things, which are not terribly good for the environment.
Right. Okay.
Some of them are greenhouse gases. Certainly, there could probably be ozone-destroying molecules. So there's other considerations that we have to think about.
Yeah, I'm much less convinced now.
It's not as sustainable as you thought it was.
Yeah.
No, I had great imaginations. But, okay, thank you, Marcus.
All right, no problem. Good to be here.
That was Dear Science.